You're listening to an encore edition of Studio Tulsa recorded earlier this year. Welcome to Studio Tulsa. I'm Rich Fisher. There's a reason they call it comfort food. Food has the ability to console and comfort better than words or physical affection at times. My guest today has always been inspired by food and the great food writers like M.F.K. Fisher and Lori Colwin. And during one time of economic distress, the mere act of reading about food brought her comfort. Kate Christensen is the author of 6 highly acclaimed novels, including the 2008 Penn Faulkner Award-winning book, The Great Man. Story of a great artist is told by the 3 women in his life, his wife, longtime mistress, and sister. But in the past few years, Christensen has turned to nonfiction and the remarkable story of her own life. She's been writing a blog that centers on food, but has also helped tell her own story. Remarkable for the fact she's remarkably well-adjusted, given her tumultuous childhood, which is recounted in the book Blue Plate Special, an autobiography of my appetites. It's published by Doubleday. She was the child of 60s free spirits. Her largely absent father was a leftist lawyer who represented San Francisco Bay Area of radicals. Her mother's family was a part of the Waldorf school movement. The memoir begins with a scarring moment of her father viciously turning on and attacking her mother. A ruthless childhood with numerous moves, Eastern boarding school, a teacher that molested her for several years, continues a restless adolescent which was anchored by her passion for food. The book is titled Blue Plate Special, and Kate Christensen is my guest today. Kate Christensen, welcome to Studio Tulsa. Thanks very much for joining us.
Thanks for inviting me, Rich. It's nice to be here.
This new book, Blue Plate Special, I understand it came out of stories you're writing on your blog, and the first question I have is, after 6 novels, you turned to memoir. What sparked you to start telling your own story, or were you sort of telling your own story somewhat in your own novels?
Well, that's a really good question. The quick answer is I've always been telling my own story, but there's a longer answer, and that is that this memoir was 15 or 20 years in the thinking before I actually wrote it. In my 20s, I lived in the East Village, and I lived in a little studio apartment on an air shaft. It was roach-infested. I paid $300 a month for it, and I was working terrible jobs, as one does after the MFA. It was dawning on me that I had a long, long, hard amount of work ahead of me before I was going to publish my first novel. And my 30th birthday was coming. I was drinking too much. I was in a bad relationship. So all around, things were not altogether copacetic in my life. And I would wake up with insomnia at 3 in the morning, and just everything is terrible at 3 in the morning. Or can be the most terrible, the dark hour. And I would read food books to comfort myself. I would read M.F.K. Fisher and Lori Colwin, and I found those books so comforting, and the whole topic of food as it related to life, and the sort of cozy, intelligent, sensuous way they wrote about it. And I would be able to go back to sleep. And I've always found that food is the most comforting thing I can think of in times of trouble. I'm not religious, so I turn to food.
I think there's one thing that food is comforting, but you're talking about the idea of food is comforting.
Well, food and language together, I think the language of food is very comforting. It sort of soothes my brain, and it turns off the part of my brain that's worrying and sort of allows this more calm, centered feeling. And I've always found it very meditative and cozy, and it takes me out of my own self, which is helpful when you're in your 20s and worried about everything. So in those days, I was an aspiring writer, not yet published, and the way that great novels I've read have made me want to write novels, these great food books I was reading made me want to write a food book, and the way great meals make me want to cook, it's all sort of connected for me, food and language and writing, and I knew even then that someday I was going to attempt this book that became Blue Plate Special, but I needed to wait until my life had some sort of narrative shape, and I needed to have a happy ending, I think. I felt like until I felt that I had a story to tell and that I could trace my life back to the beginning and trace it to something and give it a shape and give it a sort of thematic, like a novel, you know, and in the end, I had to write it as I wrote my novels. So this brings me back to the second part of your question, which is that I first wrote a chronology. I started with the blog, and from the blog, I realized that this was my next book. Finally, I was ready to write the food book. I was ready to leap from the blog into a full-length, full-on book-length narrative. And the blog is very light and very circumspect, and I don't delve all that much. I dip in and out of the past. And when I told my editor I wanted to make it into a book, the first thing he said was, "It can't be like the blog," and my heart sank. I was like, oh, no. He said, "You have to tell the whole story, and you have to tell it chronologically, and you can't leave anything out, and you really have to write straight into it, because that's what memoir is." And that's why memoirs inspire trust in the reader, because you're not holding anything back, and that's how they work. And so I set about doing that, and it was difficult and painful. There are a lot of dark things in my life. As you pointed out, my childhood was not terrible, but complicated and not altogether rosy. We were poor. There was domestic abuse. We moved around a lot. But, you know, it's not as bad as a lot of people's. And so the other thing I didn't want to do was come off as a self-pitying victim, because I'm so not. I'm really not. And I feel like this happy ending that I've created for myself comes out of a sense of real joy in life that I've always felt despite everything. And food has been a large part of that.
Well, and when you read your blog today, it seems like a pretty good life.
I have a great life.
It revolves around the food you're going to eat that day, and you know, I'm out in the meadow. I'm really enjoying, you know, and you know, of course, life's little troubles get in there too. But it's, you know, it's a good life, and when you start reading this book, you go, wow, this is a big journey, because you begin the memoir with a very vivid scene. This must have been what you were about two or three, three or four.
Yeah, I think I was two.
And your mother had a newborn just after you, and your father, who from the outward appearances, he's this exemplary guy. He's out in the early 60s. He's doing peace work. He's representing the unrepresented, really, out in the San Francisco. Your mother asked him to basically help out around the house before he leaves for work because she's just, you know, frazzled. He punches her.
He beat her up.
Yeah.
Right in front of me and my little baby sister, who doesn't remember it because she was just born.
Yeah.
But I vividly remember it. It's my earliest memory, and the horror and shock of it still are with me to this day. And writing about it was painful and hard, and talking about it is even painful. It's something that I don't think anybody can recover from. I loved my parents deeply, as most people do, and watching that happen shook me to my core as a two-year-old and affected the rest of my life. And it wasn't the only time it happened, as I say in the book. So it was something that shaped my whole idea of how men and women were together. My parents' marriage, which ended, thankfully, when I was seven, after my youngest sister Emily was born. And then we moved away, and he gradually eased out of our lives. So he's no longer a part of my life. And so that part of the book, the whole part of the book that had to do with my father, and the book sort of begins and ends with him, was a way of really accepting that he hasn't been a part of my life. And I don't know that much about him. He's a mysterious figure for me. And so I didn't have a lot of information to draw on when I wrote about him. All I can go on is my own experience of him, which was complicated and profound.
I have to ask this question. Is, you know, I remember things from my very earliest childhood, and sometimes they're very vivid events, but I always wonder in the back of my mind, am I remembering this, what actually happened, or my version of reality?
That's exactly what my question was. And I sent the manuscript in very rough form, 300 pages of chronology and memory and my reconstruction of the past, to my mother and both of my sisters. And the four of us, in a round robin of emails, they live in Amsterdam, New Zealand, and Arizona, and I live in Maine. So we couldn't exactly sit down over, you know, tea to talk about it. But we had it in all our different time zones and on all our different continents. We exchanged emails around and around and around, all between the four of us. And I think together the four of us puzzled out the past and figured it out. And I have their blessing for this book, which I feel just immensely grateful for, that it was, you know, it's hard for all of us. There are things in the past that we would all like to just forget and move on from. But I think now we're closer than we've ever been as a family, and I think this book had a lot to do with it. And the fact that I consulted them and that all of our memories pooled somehow created something that we can all agree on was what happened.
That must have been incredibly revelatory for your sisters and you, because you know, if you're seven and you're the oldest, you know, these are primal memories, you know, just sort of fleeting memories at this point for you and your sisters. Must have been incredibly revelatory for your family to go through that process.
For all of us, because what they remembered sometimes was so different from what I remembered that we all were laughing. Did we even have the same childhood? So I learned as much as they did, and I learned a lot about them, which was, you know, really the best part of it, is that I think we all know each other better now from having really talked about all this and how we all felt and what we remember. But, you know, of course my sisters were much younger and didn't have as much time with our father as I did, so didn't know him as well, and obviously were babies when a lot of this was happening.
But still, that had to be a big part of their memory, is why their father walked out and,
yep,
and basically left the family.
I was just talking to Susan, who was the baby at the table during that cataclysmic opening scene of the book, 2 years younger than me, and I was just talking to her last night. She's here visiting me now with my mother. And she said, I never knew a lot of that stuff until I read your book. And we can laugh about it, but underneath that, there's a lot of sorrow that we all feel and that we share. And it's so nice to have them to share it with.
Now, your mother's family played a big role in how you grew up. Your mother's family were adherents to Rudolf Steiner and the Waldorf schools. In fact, your mother worked at Waldorf schools, I think. And I learned a new word. This is the Steiner philosophy, is anthroposophist. What is the key beliefs of this system?
Steiner was an early 20th century clairvoyant and philosopher from Austria, and Rudolf Steiner. And I don't know that much about him because I've never read his works, but having attended a Waldorf school for 2 years and then worked at Waldorf schools for two more years, and my grandmother actually was... and grandfather, Hans and Ruth Pusch, were deep adherents to anthroposophy and really helped bring it to America from Europe in the 30s, and were part of founding the Waldorf School movement in this country. So I've gleaned a lot, even though I've never read Steiner. And I think if I had to boil down his philosophy, it's complicated and very esoteric. And I think it has to do with the threefold nature of humans. And I would encourage anyone who's interested in that to go and read Steiner, because I can't really say much
more.
It's
the physical, the mental, and the spiritual, and that it all coexists pretty evenly, and the education system's about developing very free thinkers, and I assume that's the education you had, a good part of it.
Exactly. It's very focused on the arts and the science. To me, a writer and a musician, and I never learned science until I went to Waldorf school. It was very visceral. They teach it in a hands-on way so that you actually, it's not just performing rote experiments, it's actually understanding. For astronomy, we went and stayed on Hermit Island and camped up in Maine and looked at the stars. And we also had a botany course and did the same thing and looked at the plants and actually sort of picked them and looked at them. And for physics, we did a light physics course. It was fascinating. We made Coulomb tubes, I think they're called, and actually looked at how light works. It wasn't abstract at all. It was very concrete and very experiential.
Well, from your mother's family, you quickly moved from the Bay Area, and this was something that was a part of your childhood. I guess you settled in the Verde Valley, which is around Prescott and Jerome and Sedona and all that area, and moved around there. And you know, you talk about how this is a food memoir, but really, when you were young, food was Midwestern fare.
Yeah, pretty much.
Steak and potatoes, creamed corn, and that sort of thing.
Hot dogs.
Yeah.
It sure was. Meatloaf and fish sticks and chicken pot pies. I think that Arizona cuisine was fairly Midwestern. I think a lot of Midwesterners must have settled in Arizona because... I can relate to Midwestern food very easily.
And then what was it? Was it at that point, was it just comfort, the typical comfort food for you?
Well, you know, we all love our mother's cooking, right? I mean, most mm-hmm. of us. And I just thought my mother was the best cook in the world. And everything she made, except liver and lima beans and okra and any cut of meat that had any gristle in it. And there, I read a section on childhood disgust, which I think is as profound as childhood passion for food. But her meatloaf was the best in the world. She could cook a hot dog like no one else. Yeah, it was really comforting, and it had everything to do with family and my mother and sisters and me sort of alone together for those years. We lived in Tempe for a while, and it was a wild place then. It was not cosmopolitan like it is now. It was 1970, and it was really kind of a wasteland. There was a cornfield across the street from our house in the heart of the city, for example. And it was a wild tangle of nature and people the likes of which we'd never encountered before because we came from Berkeley. So it was the total culture shock.
Yes, at that point, and you didn't have a lot of money. You're going to, you know, a public school and sort of a newcomer. And these were really shaping experiences.
Well, I think the fact that we moved around so much, and the book is constructed as much around places as it is around food. I mean, every section is titled with a place where I lived during that time, because I've really moved around a lot. And to give structure to the book, I felt like the food and the place, as M.F.K. Fisher said, the time and place of what you're eating has as much to do with the food as the food itself. And that really resonates with me, that whole idea that having had such a peripatetic life and experienced so many different places and cultures and ways of living through the years, and moving to Arizona was the first time that had happened, because I left the Bay Area, which was home, for my first 8 years. And so being a newcomer, I think, woke me up in some way at 8 years old, and that was when I first became very passionate about food. I had always liked it, but I would look at the school menu and I would see Sloppy Joe's up ahead on Thursday, and it was only Monday, and I was already excited. I couldn't wait till Thursday to have that Sloppy Joe. And something about seeing the words Sloppy Joe on the menu, and again, it's the intersection of language with food that is the most exciting part of food for me, I think.
The name of the book is Blue Plate Special, an autobiography of my appetites, by my guest today, Kate Christensen, who's the author of six other novels, including The Great Man, which won the 2008 Penn Faulkner Award. And she's our guest today on Studio Tulsa. Well, along with that moving around and learning about places through food and living in a haunted town, Jerome at that point, which was probably still almost a ghost town at that particular point.
Population 350 in those days.
Yeah, exactly. You do recount two serious episodes, and given the beginning of the memoir with the story of your father, just sort of shows these male authority figures' traumatic entry into your life. One was when you were, I think, still in Arizona, you were on a school trip down to Mexico. You had a parent sort of try to put a clumsy move on you.
He did.
and you write about it sort of humorously, but I mean, still, that's very creepy. And you had the backbone to just say, look, you ain't messing with me.
That's right.
And but then you, all of a sudden, you say, I want to go back east, and I want to get an education back east. And I guess you pretty much researched it out and applied and got accepted. And there you ran into a math teacher who sounds like a very much a serial abuser of the girls there.
He was truly creepy, and he really was a serial abuser. And it was the 70s, and now I'm finding out that this was very widespread in all sorts of schools. It's finally coming out, this truth of how adults behaved in the 70s without any sort of boundaries or sense of responsibility. I think there was among certain, I mean, not all adults, clearly, but in the world that I lived in, which was sort of a liberal, artsy world where there were hippies and there were people taking drugs and there were people exploring themselves and there was feminism and, you know, all these movements that were going on
sexual
in the time.
Sexual revolution,
the
for that
sexual
matter.
Revolution was part of it, and part of that was the breakdown of boundaries, and part of the breakdown of boundaries were that suddenly adolescence became fair game, and I was very aware of that, and it was very creepy, and I was really affected by it in a negative way, because I had trouble trusting men anyway because of my father, and to then be molested, and luckily he didn't have sex with me, but what he did was bad enough. It really again sort of made me wary and self-protective and sort of crawl even further into my shell. And I don't think there's any way you can't be affected by that. And I, again, tried to write about it in a way that wasn't dramatic, because I feel that the facts are enough, and just stating what happened, I don't need to analyze it or go into it. It happened, and, you know, I think that anyone that has experienced anything like it understands that it goes very deep.
Well, it's interesting, you know, compared to that experience with a parent where you basically had the backbone to say, you know, this isn't going to happen.
Right.
You said, you write that you were paralyzed to really do anything about it other than, I assume, resist passively, because apparently he was sleeping with other students.
Oh, yeah. Well, here's the thing. I mean, I think that I presented a tough exterior, so luckily I think he thought he probably couldn't get away with it with me. But I was away from home for the first time. I got a scholarship, and I was working for room and board because we didn't have any money. And this was a Waldorf school, and I was attending this Waldorf school, and I was living with an English teacher in the school and taking care of her kids and cooking, and this is where I first learned to cook. And doing housework in exchange for room and board. And so I was really lonely, and I was the new girl. And again, it was moving to a new place, and I was without my mother. And I feel like the fact that I had my mother back in Arizona and protecting me, and just the fact she was close, that I knew no one could get away with anything with me, with her around. She's fiercely protective. But here in this new place, everyone, there was this atmosphere of sort of kids and teachers having sexual relationships. And it felt like it was the trend or the norm or something, and I was shocked and horrified by it. But I felt like I needed somebody, and this was a father figure. He lived next door. He would take me for walks to sort of advise me on my life because I seemed depressed, which I was, and then he would take full advantage of that. Really creepy.
Mm-hmm.
But I think I couldn't speak up because I was so shy, and suddenly away from home for the first time, really afraid, and I didn't have my mother with me to protect me, and I think that that was what made the difference.
Well, this guy was incredibly brazen, and as you, creep is the right word for him, because you eventually told your mother wrote to the school, and then your grandmother intervened and put the two of you in a room, which just stretches believability, frankly. But
no,
she put you in a room and basically told the guy, don't mess with her anymore.
What happened actually was that my mother flew out there, and she and my grandmother sat down with him and said, leave her alone, stop that. I'm not sure how this confrontation went because I wasn't there. But then he came into my bedroom and said, I want to hear it from you.
Oh, my gosh.
I don't believe it. You have to tell me. And I was too shy. I folded my arms and I looked down at my feet. I was 16, and I was really young for my age and really naive. I had not had a lot of sexual experience, or any, actually, at that point. And so I just didn't know what to say. I was afraid of him. He was, you know, an authority figure. And so he just kept doing it. That's what happened. And yeah, it's shocking now. If that happened now, he would be in prison. But, you know, things have changed, thank God.
Yeah. After high school, though, you moved to France, and this really kindles your love affair with food. You become an au pair in France, and all of a sudden you're finding new ways to make pot roast.
Yeah, and it was called rabbit stew. Oh, my God, I loved it in France. It was an amazing place for me to go at 18. And again, I was an au pair girl working for room and board with a family, but this was totally different. And it was completely new and exciting. And going to Europe back then in 1980 was a very big deal. And it's not something people just casually did. It was all the way across the ocean. And getting a passport and getting on an airplane and flying across the ocean and getting off. And I got off and people were speaking a different language. And, you know, we weren't cosmopolitan back then. This was a huge adventure. And for me to hitchhike around Europe with friends was a great lark, and to experience this whole new way of eating and cooking. So I devoted an entire chapter to France because I felt it deserved it.
Yeah. And at this point, you're also thinking about writing, too. That comes in even high school. You're doing sometimes beyond the call writing exercises because your writing was in your blood.
I started writing actually at 6 or 7, and my first story was called My Magic Carpet, and it was about two sisters who ride a magic carpet around the world and stop off and eat food in various places like France and China, and then they get home in time for tea. So at 6 or 7, I was already writing, and I was already fascinated by writing about food. So this book has really been, you know, it was inevitable that I would someday write it.
Going back over your life like you have and spending so much time learning from your family, how do you think this has informed your fiction? Do you think it has affected your fiction? Because I know your next book, you're going to actually work on a memoir with somebody else for their memoir. Have you given up fiction for the time being, or are these ideas percolating, or what exactly?
I have a novel that's percolating, but it's such an early stage. And usually a novel comes out of feeling a character coming to life in my head, and so insistently that this person demands to spill over onto the page and have his or her story told. And so for that to happen, I think I have to really meditate on a character or a group of characters, as in The Great Man, for a very long time. And in the meantime, I'm really excited about nonfiction and food writing in particular. I'm co-writing the memoir of a Boston chef named Barbara Lynch, who is from Southie and is self-taught and is running a $26 million empire of amazing restaurants. I mean, she's just an amazing person. It's like a classical American success story, but she's an original. I mean, just absolutely a great voice. And so this is a whole new chapter for me, no pun intended.
Now, how has the blog affected your overall writing? I mean, does it you feel like it benefits your fiction writing and book projects, or does it get in the way sometimes?
I love blogging. I blogging's so different. It's like a completely other way of writing. And I used to keep a journal, and all my life I called it a diary, and then I got all pretentious and called it a journal when I was older. I decided I was a writer with a capital W, and they write journals. And I haven't done that in years, but blogging feels more like that. But you know, posting things online for instant readers is almost like skipping all the hoopla around publication and just going straight to the readers with it. And so there's this immediacy of connection with the readership, as well as the sense of recording my life in a very relaxed, unpressured way, unedited, just me. You know, I write a sort of stream of conscious. And then post it.
Well, then you must be a pretty good first draft writer, because it looks pretty crafted.
Hey, thank you. I've had a lot of practice at this writing thing.
Back to my question about the memoir affecting how you write other people's stories. Has it had any effect, just going through this process?
I think that I've really drew on my experience with novels to write this book. And I don't think that I'll know until I write my next novel how it's affected novel writing. But I sense just instinctively that I'm going to be a lot freer from my own story and my own autobiography, and a lot freer to fully imagine lives very different from mine. I feel that my first six novels are a set. I look at them as my New York novels and my black comic novels and this, where I was working out things from my own life. And I think a lot of writers, a lot of novelists who write a lot of books, work things out in the early books, and I'm free of it now. And I feel that viscerally. I mean, I feel that writing this book has sort of put a cap on that first set of novels, the first six, and what I write next is going to be a departure. I don't know where, but it will go somewhere new.
Yeah, we'll look forward to that. In the meantime, Blue Plate Special, an autobiography of my appetites with recipes at the end of all the chapters. And Kate Christensen, thanks very much for joining us.
It was such a pleasure, Rich. Thank you.
Kate Christensen is the author of six novels, but her latest book is a memoir, Blue Plate Special, an autobiography of my appetites. It's published by Doubleday. Well, that's Studio Tulsa for today. Our program is produced and edited by Scott Gregory. The views of our guests and commentators are their own and do not necessarily reflect the views of KWGS or its licensee, the University of Tulsa. I'm Rich Fisher. Thanks for listening.